KBOO.fm/evening news. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM. K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM. And K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Emily Gresham Beamer.
And I'm Erin J. Bernard. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, Voices from the Edge is off this week. Instead, we will be airing Final Straw Radio, a weekly anarchist and anti-authoritarian radio show, bringing you voices and ideas from struggle around the world. At 9, Press Watch with host Teresa Mitchell brings you all the news you're not supposed to know. At 9:30, it's Fight the Empire with host Per Fagering. At 10, The Heather McCoy Show welcomes best-selling author Johan Hari to discuss his new book, Lost Connections, uncovering the real causes of depression and the unexpected solutions. At 11, Between the Covers interviews author Marlon James about his latest book, Black Leopard, Red Wolf. Then at 11:30, it's Black Book Talk with Patricia Welch, Emma Ford, and Obie Hill. All of this KBOO programming is made possible by members' support. To become a member, go to kboo.fm and click on Donate.
Good evening. You are listening to News from the Boo. I am your host, Mike Crenshaw. And once again, bringing you news from in and around the KBOO community. And I am here in the halls of Benson High School at Alliance at Benson. And I've got a very special guest today. Tripp, how's it going, Tripp?
It's been going pretty good, actually.
Yeah? What grade are you in?
I'm a senior in high school.
Senior in high school? Okay. So you reached out to me, Tripp. What did you, you want to tell the people, the listeners, what it was you wanted to discuss on the air?
Well, it was a topic that I had done a little research on, and coincidentally, Mike also brought this up as well, but it's sort of economics and sort of like this, the vastness of numbers, especially when it comes to the millions and billions of numbers, and like, especially when it comes to economics and, you know, millionaires and billionaires and like the amount of cash that they have comparatively to the standard person living out in the world, so...
Okay, so you're talking specifically about wealth disparity in this society.
Yes, that would be the specific that I'm talking about.
Okay, so I gave you an article, and it was talking about what $1 trillion actually looks like. And the reason I thought that was an important article was because a lot of us hear numbers like billion and trillion tossed around, but we actually have no concept intellectually of what that really represents in a very material way. So what did you learn?
Well, it was a very interesting topic because when we think about like people like Bezos and Gates and all these other like large company holders, they have billions of dollars. And when you like, you would think, oh, $1 billion, that doesn't seem like a lot. But when you look at it and like, if you were to have a billion spoons, that would be about a whole entire room in your house dedicated to spoons. Mm. Like, you may have to put in another room just to have a billion spoons.
Do you think a billion spoons would actually fit inside a room, though, Chip?
It depends on how you do it, because, like, most people have, like, collections of, like, 10 spoons.
Uh-huh.
And they're just, like, in a little box, just sitting there, and it's like, that doesn't seem like a lot, but 10 spoons mm-hmm. is about, like, let's say it would take about probably if we're going trillion, that's 100 billion spoons
mm-hmm.
of the sets of 10s. Mm-hmm. If you look at a million, that's 100,000 of those boxes of 10s. And we just look at those numbers and see how big that is. Like, think about it like this.
Yeah.
If you're looking at $1 trillion, that's 1,000 billion dollars.
Uh-huh. So here's something interesting that I found quite remarkable in reading the article. If you were getting paid $1 a second, how many seconds would it take for you to make $1 trillion? a trillion seconds, right? Do you know how long a trillion seconds is?
Well, a trillion seconds is a very long time.
They specifically gave how long a trillion seconds is in the article, though.
I don't have the article on me, but if I remember correctly, it was like a trillion seconds was like 36, like, it was like 36,000 years would take you at that rate, and it's like 37 or so years to get $1 billion at that rate.
At a dollar a second. So a trillion seconds is 31,700 years. Okay? So that's quite a bit of time.
Most people
a second is a pretty small increment of time, right?
Most people don't live that long. Most people.
I don't think any people live 31,000 years.
Yeah.
Yeah. So how does wealth disparity show up in your day-to-day life, Trip?
Well, it shows up in the simplest of, like, being able to pay for food, rent, and any other expenses that may hit you, like medical bills, or just, like, you know, your wants and your needs, and those are two very separate things when it comes to economics. Mm-hmm. Because you need a fair amount of things to be able to survive. You need a house. You need a mode of transportation, maybe a bus, maybe a car, maybe a bike, whatever it needs to be really a thing. And you have, you know, medical. Hypothetically, every 6 months you're supposed to go to the dentist. Every year you're supposed to get a checkup from the doctor. And then you have the, let's say you get into an accident and you need to go to the doctor and pay for something. That could be, like, it was this, like, thing it was a post I saw on the internet. But it was, like, a really true thing where back in the day, a $1 million man was, like, the cyborg. Nowadays, a $1 million man is someone who got into a really bad accident and has to pay for, like, super erroneous medical bills because you have, like, the doctor who you're paying for your surgery. You have the different things, like, IV drips and different things that you need. Like, there's all these things in the world that cost so much so that a common person wouldn't be able to pay for that without going into serious deep debt.
Mm-hmm.
I was recently having a conversation with someone where they were trying to get their car fixed, and the first time they went to one of the mechanics to fix everything wrong with the car, it would cost them $8,000.
Wow.
Like, to fix everything wrong with their car. And to, like, someone who has millions of dollars, that doesn't seem like a lot. But to someone who's getting paid, like, hypothetically $12.50 an hour,
mm-hmm.
that's at least a month's worth of paycheck, more or less.
Yeah, it could actually be unaffordable. So when you see yourself being a working person, you know, what field, what career do you see yourself going into, and how much money do you think you need to make to be able to live the lifestyle that you want to live in this society?
Well, like, the one career that I really do want to go through is teaching. Mm. And the problem is that with a teaching career, it's one of the most underpaid careers. I was watching a video on Facebook today, and it was like this whole entire talk about, like, someone doing, like, this little, as a lawyer, talking about, like, putting the school board on the little, I don't know what's called, that little thing in the courtroom where you put them, you bring them before the jury.
A hearing?
Yeah, a hearing, basically. They were doing, like, this sort of mock trial thing, and they're talking about how a doctor is paid, like, thousands of dollars, like, an hour, hypothetically. Like, they're paid so much an hour that they can, you know, sustain their lifestyle, but a teacher is barely paid enough to be able to get through a month. Like, especially here at Alliance, teachers are so underfunded that they specifically have to go into their personal paychecks to pay for things they need. And that's not specific of Alliance. There are teachers all across the country, especially in more rural areas, who have to pay out of pocket for things like pencils and pens and binders and different things that students and the teachers need, but the funding isn't there enough.
Mm-hmm. So where do you think things are headed? Right now, there's this widening gap, which is, you know, what we could call wealth disparity, between poor people who are getting poorer rich people who are consolidating more wealth and resources and getting richer. So where do you think things are going to be, say, 5-10 years from now?
Well, I think, as we said in our previous interview, there are two separate paths, one in which we course correct and fix our system so that people are able to get enough, you know, naturally by the government or however you want to do it, to be able to pay for food, medical expenses. I mean, hypothetically, we're having pushes now for single payer health care, in which someone can go to the doctor, get their things taken care of, and that's paid for by the government. And like housing and all these different things would be paid for by the government, hypothetically, and if people really care about it, in a free market society in which you're able to succeed, that would only be successful if the people who are, you know, working and trying to create their own businesses have enough given to them to be able to survive without, hypothetically, their business tanking and them going into deep poverty.
So you're talking about a economic social safety net that would prevent people from going into poverty. So you're saying if we course correct, to use the term you use, that we can turn the situation around and take care of people. So how do you see that happening, though?
Well, I think it's a lot about taking the funding that we have currently into the military-industrial complex.
Uh-huh.
Billions upon billions of dollars spent yearly for defenses that truly we don't really need. We're the top military spender, and if you were to take all of the lower spenders below us, they wouldn't even add up to what we have. And those are all our allies. All these people who are spending the most amount of cash to protect themselves are our allies. We're not spending as much as our enemies. Our enemies are barely spending anything, and our enemies we have aren't exactly, you know, let's just say outside forces.
Yeah, we were having a conversation yesterday with some people that are in the city politic, the political machinery of the city, and we were talking about 5G and about how the tech giant AT&T is, you know, rolling out a plan. They're going to vote on it in the city council on the 13th to install 5G everywhere. A lot of people aren't even aware what 5G is, but basically the consequences of it will be that there's this blanket of radiation that's going to have adverse health effects for everybody in the city. So are you aware of 5G and what that is?
Yes, I very much am aware of 5G. I was listening not too long ago. It was a news article, actually. It was like a news thing that was put out by KBOO talking about even our current 4G mm-hmm. is causing, like, if you're living near a radio tower or a cell tower, there are higher cases of cancer and diseases that come from that, because these, you know, our bodies are naturally in tune with a lot of this stuff.
Okay.
And these radio waves affect our body and sort of scramble different things.
Like, right, right.
I mean, I'm not going into the level of, like, people, like, really hardcore conspiracy theorists that they're going to use 5G as a way of mind control and this kind of stuff. But on a basic scientific level, this sort of radiation that we're using to power our cell phones cause erroneous effects on the body that, if not properly taken care of, will just completely and utterly cause, you know, these effects that we don't know truly, because the testing that is being done isn't put out there. Because if it was, like, they always do the different tests on mice and different animals, but if it's like, if we were to see the results of 5G on mice, it would probably scare a lot of people, because like, they even doing tests on 4G, mice just develop tumors and all these different harmful things because of it, because it's radiation.
Right.
It's not harmful as, like, let's say the radiation that you have from an atomic bomb, but it's still radiation. The same thing that you would use to, you know, cook up a burrito in your microwave, you wouldn't want that being spread all across the airwaves.
Right, right, right. They say that the the equivalent, that 5G radiation is equivalent to the X-ray machines that they use in airport security.
And
that will be bombarding all of us 24 hours a day.
Well, I mean, think about it like this. When you go to get an X-ray at a dentist office,
right,
they make sure you put on a lead vest so that the X-rays don't affect your internal organs.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So if it's that bad in a dentist office, something like that, which is an even more powerful version of it, unless we're living in a lead house, we're not going to get any protection from it.
Uh-huh. So, you know, we're talking about a few different things, and I think, you know, you mentioned some important points. We're talking about wealth disparity, we're talking about 5G and the dangers of 5G, and I was asking you about where you think things are going to be headed in 5 to 10 years. So, taking all of this into consideration, what do you think is driving the consolidation of the wealth? What do you think is driving the military-industrial complex and the military spending? What do you think is driving this push to implement technology like 5G?
Honestly, a lot of it is, simply put, the people who have the largest amount of power in our government, i.e. corporations who do massive spending into politicians, they want to be able to sort of have a populace in which they're able to have a fair amount of control over.
Okay.
It was like the modern day sort of chain that we're, the ball and chain that we're tied to is our cell phone. It has all of our information on it. If you're using social media, that's all of your information. Like, I recently got a smartphone, and I was trying to figure out how I turn off my location services, and it's under privacy. You can't find it unless you go to your privacy settings.
Mm-hmm.
Like, these are these things where it's just like, you know, we would look back 10, 20, 30 years ago,
mm-hmm.
a lot of this stuff wasn't even around. We were dealing, a lot of the time, people didn't have a phone, mm-hmm. or if they did have a phone, they had those big old brick phones, which again, were known for causing cancers.
Right.
Like, but it's this whole entire money is what makes the modern world go round, and if you have a lot of it, you can make the say in what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't, you have your voice, yes, if you're voting, yes, you can do all this different stuff, but unless you're voting in a way that benefits the people and not the corporations or the government at large, you're not going to be able to make a true effect in the world.
Mm-hmm. So what do you do to make a difference?
Well, I always do my best to do activism work when I can and do things that I know is going to create war and peace. The sort of philosophical religious part, sort of affiliation I have through the SGI, which is the Soka Gakkai International, which is all about world peace. It was created right after the SGI, as it's known today, was created in full force not too long after the bombings in Japan by Japanese teachers it was these two men who wanted to sort of create this sort of teaching stuff.
The bombings weren't done by Japanese teachers. You're talking about Hiroshima and Nagasaki,
yeah,
when the U.S. bombed
Japan
in World War
II. That was sort of the catalyst of their sort of push, because they realized the harm of all of this, and they have this sort of method, they have this sort of phrase, it's called Kosen Rufu, which literally translates out to world peace,
mm-hmm.
which is like this idea that we can have a united world in which we don't wage wars, and we have sort of like an overarching sort of like idea that as human beings we should have a mutual respect for each other.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And every year the current president of this organization writes a peace proposal to the UN, and this year specifically, the first sentence he covered, first couple of sentences, were about climate change.
Mm-hmm.
And as he always includes in there, the denuclearization of the whole entire world. Because that was a major thing for him, being a small child in Japan and seeing the nuclear bombs drop
And these things sort of just like affected him on a very deep level. Mm. Because the person I'm referring to, Daisaku Ikeda, who he, in his sort of older days in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, went all across the world spreading peace, talking to people who normally a lot of people didn't want to talk to. Like, he was talking to leaders in communist China and communist Russia and trying to build a bridge via dialogue and having a conversation and trying to find points in which we can all have a mutual understanding and finding ways to be able to create peace. Like, one of the major things that I didn't realize until I was looking back on it, in the heyday of the Los Angeles race riots, he did a sort of like this peace activity in LA during the race riots, and everyone who was part of his staff was just like, no, you shouldn't go there, all this dangerous stuff is going on. He says, no, I'm going to go there. That's the reason why I'm going there, is because of all of this. And it's just like, this person, Daisaku Ikeda, really cares about the happiness of all living beings through that Buddhist mentality of human beings are important to the world because we are sort of the safeguard of the world in a way. We're right. Supposed to be protecting the world, but by destroying it, we're, you know, destroying our own lives.
Wow. That's deep stuff. So, one of the things we talked about, and I want to give a shout out to Lisa Loving, news director from KBOO, because she came in and talked about being a street journalist, a citizen journalist, and that was powerful. So can you tell us a little bit about what you learned about maybe the seven ways you might be able to use your cell phone as a tool as opposed to something that's just harmful and
I think the largest thing is because you have this tool that has a camera, has a camcorder, has a notes pad. Like, these are all things that back in the day most journalists had to carry a camera with them, a notepad with them, a voice recorder with them, and all these other different equipments. That's just natively in our phone. And we can use these things as a way to report on the news that's going on in the world around us. Like, simply put, if there was... Sorry, had some technical difficulties.
So wait, you were saying that if there was something happening in the community,
we could actually, you know, film it.
Uh-huh.
And, like, report it to the world at large because we have things like Twitter and Facebook and all these different media sources that we can, like, basically, like, when all these different, like, the killing of unarmed black boys are happening... A lot of the times people whip out their cell phone and start recording it live on Facebook or live on Twitter.
Okay.
And the world gets to see it, gets to see this happen. And that's something that years ago, it wasn't able to happen. If you were going to get a news story, you specifically had to go to a, you know, a specific like outlet that was covering it.
Right, right. So there are things happening in our communities that wouldn't actually be exposed to the public if it weren't for normal everyday people, you know, making newsworthy recordings with their phones and sharing that information.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. And then yesterday in Voces, there was an exercise we did. Now, Voces is a social studies / Spanish class where we talk about a lot of issues. You guys have heard students report on it before. Wealth disparity, gender, oppression, racism, capitalism, immigration. These are the type of issues that we talk about. I wanted to ask you what you thought of yesterday's exercise in which we talked about privilege, and there was a long list of privileges and disadvantages. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, privileges is like this sort of really complex thing because some things can be counted as a privilege where, like, as if someone, like, being born with white skin is a privilege in our society because the large amount of people in the ruling class are white men. So having, being a white male is a privilege. And it's not something that you can choose or anything. It's something that you're born with. And it's like this sort of, like, some privileges are natural. Some privileges happen from, like, It's just like there's some things.
What would be an example of natural privilege?
Natural privilege is being born and raised in a two-parent household.
Okay.
That's a sort of natural privilege that you have if you were born and raised in a household that did not divorce.
Okay. I could think of being born able-bodied might be a privilege, right?
Yeah, that's
definitely a privilege.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Okay. So what are you able to identify in your own life in reflecting on what privilege you might have?
Well, I mean, I am a white male.
Right.
That's the one major thing that I have in this society. My parents were well-educated but not college-educated.
Okay.
Which is one thing where it's a very privileged thing if both your parents were college-educated. But we always sort of push towards the idea of treating people with equal rights. And in my mind, that's a bit of a privilege because not a lot of people were taught the idea that people should be equal. Because, like, most people are taught that, especially in places of large bigotry, that they are superior to other people because of their color of their skin.
You said most people are taught that?
Well, I wouldn't say most people because that's a very, like, overarching term. There are certain subsects of the United States that were taught that they are superior because of the color of their skin.
Like white folks.
Yeah, largely white folks, yes.
Right. Okay. Uh-huh.
But, I mean, it's this idea that it's such a hard thing.
Uh-huh.
Because with privilege also comes responsibility.
Okay.
Because as a white person, I have to be able to support people who are disenfranchised by the world because of either the color of their skin, the fact that they grew up with one or no parents in their household, having to do the foster care, people who didn't have educated parents, and people who just were just not having the ability to live their best life.
Right.
But I mean, when it really comes down to it, we need to be able to acknowledge that people have privileges, but not to look down upon them because of their privileges. Because that's a large thing that's been happening, at least like in a large portion of society. There are white allies who try to help people of African American descent or Latino descent or any sort of different descent, but they're sort of pushed to the sidelines because they have privilege. But in reality, they are the best allies to have, because as a white person, I'm able to go in front of a city hall and speak my piece and be respected.
So how does that play into or intersect with people's right to self-determination, non-white people's right to self-determination and to be in control of their own destiny and to lead their own liberation struggles? Is it necessary for people to center whiteness and white allies in liberation struggles?
Well, I don't think that it's 100% important, but I do think that it is helpful, because to have allies of all groups, if we unite in solidarity, we cannot be stopped. When there was the pushes going on for ethnic studies in San Fran, we had Latino Americans, African American, Asian Americans, Native Americans. They all united together, and the government got scared. Because if you have a collective group of people fighting for one push, that means that there is a group behind it. And it questions a lot of the, you know, imposed ideals that white people are superior than everyone else. Which I don't subscribe to. I don't even think that that's true. I think that we all have our unique abilities based on who we are in the world. And I don't think that one race is superior than the other.
Right.
I think we all have our benefits and deficits, but we all need to be pushed up to the same level. That's part of my Buddhism as well, is pulling everyone up. Not pushing anyone down, but pulling everyone up. Because if we lift everyone up, we can be our best person. And without being our best person, we're not able to be, you know, having free will and having the ability to choose what path you want to follow. Because if you feel oppressed, you're going to be pushed down the path that the oppressors want you to.
Wow. I'd like to thank you for your time. Today's our guest was Tripp. And Tripp, what's your last name?
Burnett.
Tripp Burnett, student at Alliance at Benson. I'm Mike Crenshaw. You've been listening to News from the Boo. Peace.
Peace.
All right.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the screening of the film Hippie Family Values on Saturday, March 9th at 2 p.m. at Darkside Cinema in Corvallis. Filmed over a period of 10 years at a remote communal ranch in New Mexico, Hippie Family Values is an intimate chronicle of a handful of hippie elders along with their adult children and grandkids. The director will be in attendance. Again, that's the screening of the film Hippie Family Values on Saturday, March 9th at 2 p.m. at Darkside Cinema, 215 Southwest 4th Street in Corvallis, Oregon. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This is KBOO Portland. It's 6 o'clock. Time for Keeping Democracy Alive with Bert Cohen. Tonight is Justin Trudeau in the Pocket of Big Oil with Canadian author Judith Deutsch.
I'm Bert Cohen, and with your help, we are keeping democracy alive.
Check for pulse. Stand clear. Push to shock.
America's fascists are those people who think Wall Street comes first and the American people come second.
What we've really seen is a financial sector that's gotten out of hand, has much too much of a role in this country.
What Putin is trying to do and what Trump is trying to do is undermine faith in our government.
An absolute typhoon of terror against African Americans.
There's a huge gap between public opinion and public policy that people don't feel that they can do very much.
I speak tonight for the dignity of man.
Those of us in LBJ's old country, those of us in the lower 50, south of Canada, have often looked longingly in recent years at our north.